I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. In the last 20 years, Latino populations in the Midwest have risen dramatically, and their influence is getting bigger, too. Today, what more Latinos mean for the American heartland, culturally, economically, and politically. Then, we'll find out how an old rivalry lives on through older women. The Granny Basketball League is hosting its third annual Missouri-Kansas border show-up game this Saturday, and these women take the phrase, off your rocker, to a whole nother level. Finally, Brian McTavish is here with his weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. I'm Steve Kraske. Today we'll learn what a rise in the Latino population means for Midwest cities and rural areas. Then the old border war rivalry between Kansas and Missouri is going to heat up again this weekend. This time it's not the Jayhawks and the Tigers, but the Greyhawks versus the Shooting Stars in Granny Basketball. Yeah. You heard that right, Granny Basketball. First, though, a privately run federal prison in Leavenworth has been facing questions over recordings of meetings between attorneys and clients. Yesterday, a federal judge appointed a special master in the case. We're joined now by KCUR's Dan Margulies. And Dan, good morning.
Morning, Steve.
First of all, Dan, who did the judge appoint here?
She appointed a Cleveland attorney by the name of David R. Cohen.
And what's David R. Cohen going to be doing?
Let me tell you a little bit about him first,
sure.
Just by way of background. He is somewhat unusual, Steve, in that his entire practice consists of serving as a neutral party, as an arbitrator or a mediator attempting to resolve legal disputes, or as in this case, a special master appointed by the judge in what are typically very complex cases, like mass torts, antitrust, multi-district litigation. So it's rare for a special master to be appointed in a criminal case such as this is, but there are such occasions, particularly as is the case here, where privileged attorney-client communications have been seized in a case for whatever reason.
So in this case, Dan, he'll be doing what exactly?
Yeah, so for starters, Steve, he'll be looking at the feasibility of identifying the confidential information contained in the recordings that you referred to in the introduction and other material that has been turned over to the court. Again, just to remind you, this whole brouhaha arose in the context of a massive criminal case in which the government alleged that inmates, corrections officers, and others at the Leavenworth Detention Center were smuggling contraband and drugs into the prison. Part of the evidence in the case consists of recordings, video and audio both, of inmates' activities, and it emerged that those included conversations and meetings that were supposed to be off limits, namely between attorneys and their clients. So the judge, Julie Robinson, has limited her order thus far, but she's left open the possibility that she'll ask Mr. Cohen to expand the scope of his investigation, including examining the actions of the U.S. Attorney's Office in Kansas City, Kansas, which apparently had access to those recordings.
Well, all this can't be cheap. Who's going to be paying his fees, Dan?
Well, I'll tell you how much he charges. It isn't cheap. It's $500 an hour. That's his typical fee. And the judge has said that the government is going to have to bear the costs, 100%.
Okay. That's KCUR's Dan Margulies filling us in on this important case. Keep us informed, Dan.
Will do.
The Midwest Latino population has risen rapidly in the past 20 years, both in urban and rural areas. As elsewhere in the country, the shift in demographics has come with mixed receptions and controversy. Ruben Martinez, the director of Michigan State University's Julian Zamora Research Institute and editor of the book Latinos in the Midwest. He studied the ways in which an increase in the Latino population has impacted the Midwest culturally, economically, educationally, and even politically. Ruben Martinez joins us by Skype this morning from his offices at Michigan State University. Professor, so nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning, Stephen. Great to be with you.
You know, tell us about the changing Latino population here in the Heartland. How is it changing?
Well, it is growing rapidly. This is occurring across the country. And here in the Midwest, when I talk about the Midwest, I'm talking about 12 states that are in the Great Plains, from the Dakotas down to Kansas and so on. I think one of the things that we need to pay attention to is that the rate is going on at about 75%. It's increasing. So from, say, 2000, we were about 3.5 million, and we're about 5.5 million today. So it's increasing rather rapidly.
I mean, that's dramatic change. Obviously, that begins to speak to impact here. Lots of impact around the Midwest. What have you noticed most directly?
Well, it's a very multidimensional, complicated process. One of the things that's very clear is that the American population is aging. Mm-hmm. And in some states, we now have more people who are, a greater proportion of them are over 65 years of age and are larger than the number of persons below the age of five. So that's very dramatic in terms of what's going to happen for the future in terms of the economy. And that's happened here in Michigan, and I think it's taking place in some other states as well. But, you know, there are also some cultural issues that are taking place. The Midwest historically has not had a lot of contact with the Latino population, and that has happened over the last, 25, 30 years. A lot of these communities really are not prepared in terms of institutional capacity to provide services to them, particularly the kids, because you need bilingual, bicultural personnel in the schools. And the schools typically don't have that in the Midwest, particularly communities that haven't had a long contact with these populations. Right. It's happened in Kansas and it'll happen in Illinois, but not in a lot of the other places.
I was going to say, but still, speaking relatively here, this has all happened very, very quickly. And, you know, we've done stories here on our program, Ruben, about cities like Garden City, Kansas. And it's been a couple years since we've done something on Garden City. But my overall sense has been, despite the fact that the influx of Latinos has been dramatic, that Garden City has handled it relatively well. Just generally speaking, as you look around the Midwest, how well have most cities done when it comes to welcoming these new citizens into their midst here?
Well, we have a lot of variation, but I think generally speaking, most communities have done well. I mean, there's like Dayton, Ohio, which has been proactive in welcoming immigrants. Michigan is a state that is overall welcoming immigrants, and Illinois. In some other communities, you know, these intergroup relations go through phases. So initially, when the newcomers start coming in, there's kind of an interest in them because they're different. Mm-hmm. But then when they come in greater numbers, the local population begins to get threatened. They begin to think that things are going to change, that their culture is going to change, and so forth. And they may move to developing hostile approaches, such as, you know, not trying to passing policies not to rent to them. This happened in some communities in Nebraska. Those
actually
never
passing
really
policies
last.
Saying we will not rent to Latinos in our community.
Right.
Wow.
Literally.
Wow.
Yeah. Doing something like that,
yeah.
Particularly immigrant Latinos.
Mm-hmm.
And this really depends, you know, the next phase really depends on the local leadership. If progressive leadership steps up, they can take this hostility in a different direction and, you know, provide forums and other venues by which people begin to address these issues in a constructive way. If that doesn't happen, if the leadership itself is hostile to the newcomers, then you're setting in motion sort of a longer-term conflict between the groups. So luckily, I think across the Midwest, we have had leadership that basically says, you know, these people are contributing to our economy. They're contributing to our communities. We want them to be part of our communities. And that's the general direction that most places have taken.
You said a few minutes ago, Ruben, that a community like Dayton, Ohio, where I used to live there once upon a time, has been proactive in terms of welcoming Latinos into the community. What does that mean? What have they done proactively to be welcoming?
I think they develop programs, and it's not just for Latinos. It's immigrants generally. They develop government offices that will provide services to them, like promoting English programs, learning how to speak English, and helping them have resources relative to accessing information that will be beneficial for them at the local level, and just creating a climate that basically says, you know, we value the diversity that the immigrants bring to our communities.
I'm wondering if there's kind of a network here among Latinos that begins to suggest that, hey, these communities are welcoming and friendly, but you might want to stay away from these other communities. And I'm wondering if that's showing up in some of the population trends that you're looking at.
Are you saying that among Latinos themselves,
yes,
they communicate amongst themselves,
yes,
which way to go?
Absolutely.
I think that, yeah, that is always something that's there. I mean, all populations communicate that way.
Yeah.
But it also, you know, job opportunities are the magnets. So they will go to communities. You know, I have a colleague in Illinois who just did a comparison of two communities in Illinois that they're relatively small rural communities, you know, communities maybe of 10,000, kind of like Garden City, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them is more accepting and welcoming. The other one is more restrictive and a little less welcoming than the other one. But still you know, what happens in those communities that are relatively hostile, the community just kind of falls back into itself and they develop the linkages to be able to survive and to try to make do in those contexts in the hopes that in the future things will get better.
What's the benefit for communities that decide they want to be welcoming?
Oh, I think it helps them develop a sense of a culture that is dynamic and changing, but that still retains the basic elements of, you know, democracy, freedom, and so forth. I think there's a lot of cultural exchanges that begin to happen. You have cuisine begins to change. You have cultural events that begin to happen that give new opportunities for the locals, the longtime locals, to learn about other cultures, to benefit from the music and cultural attributes that those groups bring. And of course, I think knowing that these people from these communities are contributing to the local economy, I think that's also one of the great benefits to the local community. I mean, today in the Midwest, there are studies that show that were it not for the Latinos coming in and doing the kind of work that they do in these communities, that these communities would have had severe economic problems.
Well, nationally speaking, where is the growth in the Latino population the strongest?
Well, I think across the country, you know, if we go by regions, the relative growth, if you think about it in terms of you know, proportions, the southern states have seen a good increase in Latinos. The Midwest is the next one, but of course, you know, most of the Latinos across the country are concentrated basically in two states. Used to be two states, now it's three. They're concentrated. The largest concentration is in California.
Mm-hmm.
The next concentration is in Texas, and then the next one is in Florida.
Uh-huh.
We have now in Florida, first of all, Latinos are a very diverse population. You have the native-born who tend to be of Mexican-American origin. Then we have Puerto Ricanos and Puerto Ricans. Then we have the Cuban community that came after the change in the regime in Cuba. And then we have lots from Central America, Mexico, and some from South America. Florida has seen a very large increase of Puerto Ricanos coming from the island and moving into the state because of the kind of economic circumstances that they face over there. So I think we're going to see Florida become heavily influenced by the Puerto Rican population.
We're visiting with Ruben Martinez, who's editor of the book Latinos in the Midwest, about the growing population here in the heartland. He'll be speaking about this at 6:30 on Monday evening at the Central Library downtown in Kansas City, Missouri, 14 West 10th Street. More information or to grab a seat, just go to kclibrary.org. When it comes to Kansas and Missouri, given the array of choices that any ethnic group would have, including the Latinos, why do they pick Kansas and Missouri? What's the attraction here?
I think there's a couple of things. One, Kansas up to about the 1930s was the state that has had the highest concentration of Latinos in the Midwest. And so they're long-standing there. You have very long-standing communities. And Missouri is more of a site. I mean, there's been Latinos here for a long time, but not in great numbers. And I think, what we found at the turn of the century is we saw a lot of meat processing plants coming into the Midwest, moving out of the South into the Midwest. So there are these economic job opportunities that have taken hold in the Midwest. And I know that Kansas City there also has some meat processing plants. And also, there's a lot of agricultural workers coming into the region.
You've done some research on state governments, Ruben, and the laws being passed in terms of how they affect Latinos. What did you find as far as Missouri and Kansas is concerned?
Well, Missouri right now is one of the more, I would consider, reactionary or relatively hostile states to Latinos. I think it's the political climate that's taken hold there over the last couple of decades. I would say that Kansas is a little bit more accommodating, and it may be because of that longer historical presence there, and also the fact that the plants need that labor force to come in. But I think it's basically just the statewide political climate that's taken hold that is the difference between those two states.
So you're seeing a fairly sharp distinction between Missouri and Kansas.
I'm not sure it's a sharp distinction, but certainly a distinction. Kansas is not exactly like Illinois, which is openly welcoming, or Missouri, or Michigan, which is openly welcoming. But so it's in between, I would say, on a spectrum. You'd have like Illinois, Michigan being more welcoming, and then Kansas in the middle, and then Missouri less welcoming.
How are Latinos reacting to this year's presidential race? What are you seeing, the Latinos who are here in the Midwest? What are they thinking? Where are they going in terms of support for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
Well, one of the things about politics is that when you threaten a population group, you tend to mobilize them. And I think the presidential candidate Donald Trump, because the comments and remarks that he's made about immigration, has threatened the Latino population, particularly with regard to immigrants. And the rest of the population knows that when Latinos are targeted, there's usually involves racial profiling and so forth. And as a result, everybody is impacted by it. So what we are seeing is that there's a greater proportion this year of Latinos supporting the Democratic Party, or this Democratic ticket, if you will, than we have seen in the last couple of presidential elections, so that they're way over 70%+ supporting the Democratic Party, where in the past they were maybe just a little over 60%.
And how energized are they?
Well, I think they're very energized. You know, like I said, I think threatening populations mobilizes them. So they know that things would not go well for the population were the candidate Trump to be elected. And so, you know, they want to make sure that they're not in dire circumstances. The other thing of it is that Latinos tend to be politically, socially conservative, but liberal in terms of economics. So they support government. They believe that government ought to help people who cannot help themselves or people who are in need. They support social programs for people. And I think we see a difference between the two candidates in that regard, where one candidate is more supportive of social programs and the other one is, you know, wants small government and everybody on their own.
Is the support for Hillary Clinton substantial enough that you could see one state flipping from what might be more typically Republican control to the Democratic ticket, given the influx of Latinos?
I think where the electorate is very closely tied or split between the two candidates, Latinos will make the difference.
That's interesting. Is there one state that you could see flipping from what it might have been historically more Republican going Democratic to going Democratic this time?
You know, they tend to be Democratic on some at the state level, if you will, and Republican at the national level. So it's kind of difficult to say, okay, are they flipping on that? But the one that's interesting is Nevada, because you have a high proportion of Latinos there, and at least the polls seem to indicate that they're going Republican this time around. So it'll be interesting to see if that's going to happen. I think Georgia is another one, particularly Georgia, will let us know what the influence of the Latino electorate is going to be, because I think, you know, Georgia tends to go red, if you will. And yeah. I think this year it looks like it might be going blue. And that's where Latinos will make the difference.
Ruben, what are the most popular cities in Missouri and Kansas for Latinos? Are a few cities, do they stand out on the map?
Well, I think the larger cities are the ones where the opportunities are. I mean, basically, we have a country that where the majority of the population lives in urban centers, so that's where the job opportunities are. You also have the agricultural areas and the meat packing plants that attract them, but those are not in great numbers. So you'll find them in St. Louis, you'll find them in Kansas City, you'll find them in Columbia, you'll find them in the large major centers.
How can our communities here in the Midwest be more welcoming to the Latino population? What do we need to think about? What do we need to do in your estimation?
Well, I think one of the most important things is to think about ways to incorporate them into our mainstream institutions. These people have come to try to make a living here. They know that they have to adapt culturally. And one of the things that would really benefit, I think, the parents would be to find ways to provide programs whereby they can learn English. You know, there's this sort of political sentiment out there that says, you know, these immigrants aren't assimilating, they don't want to learn English. That's absolutely false. They want to learn English. But if you look around, there's not that many programs available to them.
That's interesting. You mentioned a little while ago about how prepared or ill-prepared some Midwestern states were for this influx of Latinos. You just finished a study of something, it sounds a little arcane, but it was interesting to me, extension agents, county extension agents, and you found some issues there. What did you find out?
Well, one of the key things that I found out is that, you know, the extension units have what we would call outreach educators. These are professionals who are out in the communities,
yes,
working with different segments of the population. And what we find is that a lot of these educators feel that they do not have the resources, nor do they have they developed the skill sets to be able to work effectively with Latino communities. And they want more resources allocated to that so that they get more training, so that they feel more comfortable being able to work with these communities. And they also don't know these communities very well, so they want to know how they can work with them and get to know them better. So I think that's an instance or an example of an institution which needs to begin to address its own capacity relative to Latino communities so that it can be better serve them. And I think the employees themselves, the outreach educators, are saying, yeah, we need some help in this area.
And likewise, what have you found in public schools across the Midwest when it comes to their ability to bring in Latinos and offer them the quality education that everyone needs?
Well, some school districts are working to do it. I think particularly in Iowa, for instance, the extension agents there have developed a program that was developed in the South, I think in North Carolina, titled Juntos, which means together. And that is, they offer these programs to parents and high schoolers together and help them understand what it takes to graduate from high school, helps them understand what the pathways are to get to college, and it's working very well. So some school districts are, you know, recognizing that they have to tackle these issues, allocate resources to get personnel who are bilingual, who can serve as cultural translators, if you will, between the communities and the school districts. But, you know, over time, resources generally for government have been diminished. So everybody's strapped in mm-hmm. being able to do these things. That's one of the great challenges. And I think that is what distinguishes the two presidential candidates today.
Ruben Martinez will be speaking at 6:30 Monday evening at the Central Public Library in downtown Kansas City, 14 West 10th Street. You can get a seat by going to kclibrary.org. Ruben, thanks so much for your time. Really enjoyed it.
Stephen, thank you very much.
Time for a break here. When we come back, we're going to talk about something that maybe you haven't heard of before, and that's something called the Granny Basketball League, and it's reviving this rivalry between Kansas and Missouri. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's program, the media critics evaluated coverage of Election 2016. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, gender-based violence abroad and how abused women and children are finding asylum here. Also, learn about two Missouri and Kansas ballot measures voters will decide on in November. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, the Kansas-Missouri rivalry goes back to the 1850s. Originally, the dispute was over slavery, but years after the end of the Civil War, things transitioned into an athletic competition between KU and Mizzou, but those games stopped in 2012. Now, a group of older women has found a fun way to keep the transition alive. It's called Granny Basketball. The rules are a little different than what we're used to. It's 6-on-6. There's no running, no touching, no jumping, and players only get 2 dribbles apiece. Granny Basketball will host their 3rd MOCAN show-up game this Saturday in Jefferson City. The series is currently tied at 1-1. Joining us by phone this morning is the founder and current league president of Granny Basketball. That's Barb Trammell. Barb, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining us here in the studio is Michelle Clark of the Kansas Prairie Storm based in Topeka. Michelle, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us is a former player for the Missouri Shooting Stars, Laura McAllister. She's now a referee for the league. And Laura, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Laura, let's start with you. I need to be careful asking this, but what's the age range of players in Granny Basketball?
Anybody who's 50 and over.
Oh, just 50 and over.
Yes.
So 50-year-olds are willing to be called grannies.
Yes.
Even if they're not.
Correct.
Officially a granny.
I am not a granny.
But
I,
you're still a granny I'm basketball player.
Yes, I am.
Okay. Barb, how'd the league get started?
Well, it was kind of an accident, really. Up here in Lansing,
These
Iowa.
These things are always an accident, Barb.
I wanted a way to exercise, but I didn't like doing anything, except I remembered that back in the day, I loved playing basketball. And my dad was a girls' basketball coach in the 40s and 50s. And he was telling me about the game that he originally saw back in 1920 in Bondurant, Iowa. And he described the old three-court game. Iowa is mostly known for the half-court game.
Yeah, they play basketball different up there, don't they?
Well, they do. They play regular 5-on-5 now, but back in the day, 6-on-6 was the big thing.
I remember the first time I saw that on TV when I used to work up there at a newspaper in Dubuque, and I didn't know what I was looking at. I was just fascinated by it. Yeah. So, but the game you're talking about is even different than that, though, right?
Yes. Before 1935, the girls played in 3 courts rather than 2. And they wore bloomers and midi blouses, and it was the rules were very refined and dainty, actually, because the powers that be thought that girls were too fragile to run and jump. And so they didn't allow that. And they couldn't show any flesh, and they couldn't jump and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so after I learned about that, after Dad told me about it, I thought, well, gee, as old as I am, I could even do that. And so we were trying to earn money for an old school building in Lansing. Lansing, Iowa.
Iowa, yeah.
It's a town of 999 people.
I know where Lansing is, yeah.
Yeah. And so I kind of combined those ideas and got together some of my friends. I recruited some tall women from Walmart and so forth.
From Walmart? Are they tall at Walmart?
Well, no, but that's just a place where a lot of people are.
So ah, okay.
I try to recruit from church and that kind of thing. So we decided to put on an exhibition game and use the proceeds to donate to the Old Stone School.
Mm-hmm.
And after that happened, nobody wanted to quit playing. And gradually, as we got media attention, the game just kept growing and growing. And so we went from 4 teams and then 6 and then 8, and we were mostly in Iowa. Then Minnesota joined in, and after that, Missouri found out about us. I don't know how these people find out about it, but anyway, it's just grown, and it refuses to stop.
Well, Michelle Clark, so how is the game that you guys are going to be playing here, how is it different than a KU men's basketball game? What's different about it?
Well, I think the excitement will be just as high if we're very close to it, I believe. But
if you can get there, you're doing pretty well.
I know. I mean, you just can't beat a granny shot.
Yeah.
So, but it'll be the 6-on-6 game. We'll be playing with 1920s style rules. And
explain that. 6-on-6 meaning what exactly?
Well, it'll be 2 guards, 2 forwards, and 2 centers. Each of those 2 players in each court and each team. We'll have that. So all together, there'll be 12 players on the court.
Okay, and you'd go from 5 to 6 because why?
Well, I think I might defer to Barb on that one. It's really fashioned after the 1920 style rules.
So and the game, Barb, it's 6-on-6, but it's the same game that people would recognize today?
No.
Okay.
They wouldn't recognize it at all.
Okay.
Most people don't even remember the half-court game,
right,
where we played 3-on-3 in 2 courts, basically. But this is in 3 courts, and so you have 2 forwards, and they have to stay in their third of the court, and the 2 centers have to stay in their third of the court, and the 2 guards have to stay in their third of the court. So basically all you do is dribble twice, pass the ball to the next person until it gets down to the forwards, and then the forwards shoot. And they're the only ones that can shoot in this game, and the rest of them just stand there and wait for the ball to come.
I see. And this is played on 1 basketball court, but the players can only go in certain parts of the court.
That's correct.
Okay, I'm getting it now. Okay. And this is working, Laura, as you watch this, people are drawn to this.
Oh, they are. Just because we can't run, touch, jump doesn't mean they don't once they get on that court. They're very competitive. They come for fun, but anytime you get people playing against each other, they want to win.
Yeah. Michelle, can you talk to us about the Missouri-Kansas rivalry here? I mean, what's on the line when you guys meet up this weekend?
Well, quite honestly, this is a blossoming or a blooming rivalry. We just got started with it. I used to live in Missouri, and that's where I was introduced to Granny basketball. I was a part of the very first year that it got started in 2011. And then I moved to Kansas in the Topeka area for a job and family, and I was granny-less. So fortunately, I was able to still play with my friends in Missouri when we traveled to Nationals or the Jamboree in Lansing, Iowa, or Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
Yeah.
But I was always getting the question from my Missouri friends, when are you going to get it started in Kansas? So this past year, we are now at 3 teams, two based in Lawrence and one in Lewisburg, Kansas.
No kidding.
So it's just so exciting to see the women having so much fun with it.
Well, are you a forward? Are you a shooter?
Well, actually, I have a distinction. I played 1 year in high school, and I went through the whole season without making a single point. So I will admit that. But it's coming along. It's coming along.
So are you a shooter now?
Well, I probably contribute better in the defense and getting the ball away from the other shooters, but mm-hmm. I do enjoy shooting when I can get a chance.
And how intense is this rivalry? What's your sense, Laura, as you look at this?
Well, they're coming in as the Kansas Prairie Storm. They'll go home as the Prairie Drizzle.
Just that simple, right?
Yes.
What's your sense, Barb, of how intense this rivalry is?
Well, it kind of depends on the players. We have people that, particularly the ones that played in high school, that are competitive in the deepest part of their soul. Mm-hmm. And they really like to win, and they'll do whatever it takes to win. And then there are the others who aren't so involved in competition. I think the women who were used to being competitive are probably more competitive now than the other ones were. And really, I think about a third of our players have never played before, and so they have to learn all over again. But they don't have that deep down dirty playing. No, not that we play dirty. But,
yeah.
just a fire in the belly, I guess you could say.
Yeah. When are we going to have a game in Kansas City?
Well, we hosted Missouri in Lawrence on April the 2nd.
Okay.
And so we played two games, and it was tied up. So we're now venturing. Missouri promised to host us this fall, and so now the day is very near.
What was the final score of that game? Or just roughly?
The first game was lost by only 2 points, so Kansas lost the first game.
How many points were scored in the whole game?
Oh, what was the score? 38-36, something like that.
So it was close.
Uh-huh. And then the second game, it was a little broader spread, and the Kansas team won the second one.
Well, Laura, I've heard of a showdown, but what's a show-up game, which is what's going on in Jefferson City this weekend?
Well, as I said, as we discussed earlier, you have to be 50 or older, which means we have players that are 60, 70, even in their 80s. So sometimes it's just a matter of being able to get out of bed in the morning and get up and show up.
You have players in your 80s who show up?
We do. Mm-hmm. Kansas has a lady who's 84. It's a fascinating story. In fact, the Kansas City Star did a front page story
on her. Well, tell me about her.
I will defer to Michelle.
Well, actually, we have two players in their 80s. Kathleen is 82 and Pat is 84. She graduated from high school in 1950, if you can imagine that, and dearly loves the game. I think all of our players dearly love the game. That's why they're back out and delighted to be able to play again. Pat played at the University of Kansas in their intramural teams for women and has a pretty wicked hook shot. So and she's just a delight. We just love all of our players. Well, and it's great.
Barb, am I getting the impression here that this is just novel enough that you're seeing big crowds show up for these things?
It depends on the game. We do a lot of fundraisers and exhibition games, and there are a lot of people that attend those. When we have our games, our league games, it kind of depends on the town. Like, there's a little town called Harper's Ferry in Iowa, and people just hang from the rafters to watch them. My team, which is the Great Dames, sometimes we have a pretty good crowd. Other times, kind of depends, I guess, on what else people have to do. But we are very happy with the attention that we get. And by the way, the oldest player in Iowa is 90. She'll probably be 91 this year.
No kidding. Well, Laura, you don't play for Missouri anymore. What happened?
Well, you have to have referees in addition to players.
Yeah.
So I became certified as a referee and found I really like it.
Do you miss playing?
Not at all.
Really?
Really.
What do you like about refereeing?
You get to be involved in the whole game. You get to be a little bossy, which is kind of my nature. I just found, you know, we all have kind of the areas we like, and I found I like being a referee.
And what's the most common foul you tend to call?
Touching.
Can't touch.
There's supposed to be a least 3 inches between you and the other player, and that is just really hard for these players to not do.
Yeah, okay. Why are the rules different than NBA or college ball? Why is that?
Because when Barb founded the league, she based it on when her dad was a coach and decided to base it on the 1920s rules.
Yeah. Do most of the women have prior basketball experience, Barb, or not really?
No. Quite a few of them do, but about a third of them have never played before. Some of the ladies were in surrounding states, and they watched while the Iowa girls played, but they weren't allowed to. And so now they get their opportunity, and they're just thrilled to pieces. There was this one girl who lived in Dubuque, but she used to live across the river in Illinois. And when she heard about Granny Basketball, she called me up, and she says, "I want to play Granny Basketball, and I want to play right now." She didn't get to play when she was in high school. And we were 6-on-6 girls basketball half court when we played. It was just a small town phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
The large schools wouldn't allow the girls to play. There was a girl in Des Moines who tried to get a team together to play, but she was in a big school and they made her quit because they didn't think it was ladylike.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess all the Iowa farm girls didn't care about that. So they were the ones that played. The big schools did not participate.
Barb, where'd you come up with the name Granny Basketball?
Well, I actually named it for the granny shot, which is between the legs.
What?
Well, yeah.
You mean like you whip it behind you, but between the legs?
No, not behind.
Or in front. Okay,
you're,
I got
in
you.
Front,
yeah.
You hang on to the ball. You
like the way Wilt Chamberlain used to shoot free throws. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. The way they used to do free throws.
Okay. Michelle, what do the ladies do off the court?
Well, we have just a tremendous group of ladies that have come together. Some are retired, some still work, some are business owners, some are teachers. We just have an amazing variety of ladies that are coming together.
Do you like run wind sprints and stuff during your practices?
Well, we usually practice for 2 hours, and we'll spend half of the time just doing drills and warming up and still trying to get some skills. And then we'll spend the other half the hour scrimmaging and practicing, getting
That's
ready to
fun.
Play the Iowa teams and the Missouri teams.
Barb, is there typically a lot of trash talk going on leading up to a game?
No, not at all. In fact, that's a technical foul.
You ever called a technical foul, Laura, over trash talking?
Not yet, no.
Yeah. How many dunks might we see during a weekend game, Barb?
Well, you can't jump, so there are no dunks.
Oh, you can't jump. That's
right.
One of the rules.
No,
you can't jump?
No, you can't.
How did I miss that? You can't jump. Okay.
Well, that's one of the hardest things for people to learn, too, because when you go up for a layup, you know, automatically you lift both of your feet up off the floor and jump, or try to jump for a rebound or something. You can't do that. So
it's a
whole different game, for sure.
Well, the Granny Basketball Mocan Show-Up game is going on at noon on October 15th at the First Christian Church in Jefferson City. More information, GrannyBasketball.com. I want to thank our guests for coming in today. Barb Trammell. Barb, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And with the Kansas Prairie Storm, Michelle Clark. Michelle, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Laura McAllister, who's now a referee in the league. Laura, thank you very much. And good luck this weekend, guys.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Coming up, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
Under blue skies, sun is blazing, feels amazing. Memories is what we making. Hearts are racing, girls we chasing. Soaking up these summer raisins. Music's bumping, fists are pumping, laughing, and we keep it coming. Living like it's now or never, and the moment's all or nothing. You ain't gotta have a lot of money in your pocket. You can show up in whatever, like whatever. I'm a rocket. You don't need no invitation. We ain't got no special tickets, cause we're all just normal people, and we hope that you can pitch it under blue skies.
Brian McTavish is here to talk about cool stuff to do this weekend. He writes and talks about pop culture every week, and he's here, and so glad to have you here. How are you?
I was never able to master the granny shot.
The between the legs.
Yeah, the between
thing.
The legs, right.
Will Chamberlain never quite did either.
And didn't Rick Barry?
Rick Barry shot.
He also,
very good, very
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
Rick Barry shot free throws that way, too.
He did indeed. Well, let me ask you, what was your greatest accomplishment in junior high? Come on.
I didn't have an accomplishment in junior high. I read the entire Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, played football.
Wow.
Offensive guard, a little boy with my pants falling down when I was in seventh grade. It was kind of funny.
All right.
Yeah, how's that?
I like that.
Two accomplishments.
Maybe two and a half there. Well, do you know what Matthew David Morris's greatest accomplishment is?
That's who we're listening to
right
now.
Yes, way better known as Matty, M-A-T-T-Y-B. He's a 13-year-old internet pop star. That's his greatest accomplishment.
Wow.
Right, yeah. He's in middle school. He's performing 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Sunday. 3 o'clock by...
Because an evening concert, he might be past his bedtime
or
something.
Or the audience. Yeah, the teeny boppers might be getting ready for school on Monday.
Yeah.
He's doing a show at 3 o'clock Sunday at Arvest Bank Theater at the Midland. Get a load of these numbers. I mean... 4 billion with a B video views.
Wow.
10 million YouTube subscribers. If you put all of his Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter action combined, put it all together, he's got 12 million followers. And as we speak, he is among the top 50 most viewed all time on YouTube and Vevo.
Wow. Yeah. Matty B.
Yeah, yeah.
Never heard of him.
He's pretty good, though. Does he sound like he's 13?
Sounded good to me.
He's been doing this since he was only 7 years old. And what this is testament to is that in this day and age, Steve, if you've got it, you can make it without necessarily signing to anybody in particular.
You just do your own thing.
You just do your own thing.
Which is maybe a fairer way to do it.
It's seemingly more democratic, but I do think that as you get up the ladder, you still have to take on the managers and the other hangers-on. Hopefully, Matty B is avoiding that fate.
Okay.
Anyway, check him out Sunday if you're young at heart or if you're just young. Great show.
Don't leave me in all this pain. Don't leave me out in the rain. Come back and bring back my smile. Come and take tears away. I need your arms to hold me now. The nights are so unkind. Bring back those nights when I held.
That's the great Toni Braxton, who will be in town this weekend.
It is indeed. Now, Toni Braxton, sultry songstress and star of the WE's Braxton Family Values, she just keeps on turning up the steam. I mean, she is such a romantic singer, and what a range in those pipes, right?
Mm-hmm.
8 o'clock Friday night, Sprint Center. It's her greatest hits tour. It's the hits tour, right?
Yeah.
But here's the thing we should mention. Fans probably are already aware of this. I was a little surprised to learn that she only just a week or two ago was in the hospital.
Hmm.
Right. She has lupus, that autoimmune disease, and she spent 3 or 4 days in the hospital just, like I say, just a couple of weeks ago, but she's going on with the show, and I guess that's what you do when, you know, your fans want you. She's talked about having lupus since bringing it up to the public in 2010, and she's not shy about it, but I guess if you're a reality TV star, what don't you talk about, right? Just the last night, she did a concert in Detroit where they have a video of it online right now where she broke down talking about her struggle and how grateful she was to still be there playing for the fans. And she will also, she'll sing Unbreak My Heart, and she'll also talk about having a good time at the party, and her concert is a party. So,
okay,
hey, have a great time. Tony, stay strong.
Be sure to see Brian Six exposing things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org.
The men in my life keep getting killed by Kandarian demons.
All the men in your life keep getting killed by Kandarian demons.
First there was Ed, a really nice guy.
What do we have here? What is this?
What's going on around here?
I can tell that.
All right. In 1981, they made a cheapo little horror movie called The Evil Dead.
Mm.
It spawned several sequels, And it's sort of a campy horror film franchise, right? Well, a few years ago, somebody got the bright idea to, hey, we can make a musical out of this. So enter Evil Dead the Musical, a super over-the-top show, lots of blood, lots of, well, I presume it's fake blood. Anyway, there's a splatter zone down front.
I know. Okay.
Right, exactly. We will not be, I dare say you and I, we will not be in the splatter zone down front.
I don't think so.
No, I don't think we will be. Yeah. So I'm sorry for being such stick in the muds. But anyway, you can be in the splatter zone or nearby or watch people get splattered with the fake red stuff at 7 tonight, 8 o'clock Friday and Saturday, and 7 o'clock Sunday. At Evil Dead the Musical, it's on the H&R Block City stage at Union Station. And the lesson you'll learn from this is do not open the Book of the Dead if you're one of five or six college students inhabiting an abandoned cabin in the middle of nowhere. Because if you do, you will also be dead. Or maybe survive a close brush.
Whatever you
Reaper.
Say.
No,
Whatever
no.
You
Lots
say.
Of fun. Comedy, blood, good times.
Now, this is the great George Winston. I used to listen to him many years ago, the new age artist.
Yeah.
Great fame, and solo piano was his thing.
But it's a man and his piano.
Yes.
Okay, and he's been doing the same act now for decades.
Yeah.
He was part of this commercialization of instrumental music, which got called new age music.
That's right.
Kind of a cousin to soft jazz or whatever that was. But this guy, you know, he didn't just play ball with this genre. He exceeded it. He brought his own game. And so what he has done over the last 30 or 40 years is shown the intricacy yet the accessibility of the piano. 7 o'clock Sunday night, Helzberg Hall at the Kauffman Center, and he'll throw in some Linus and Lucy there too for you.
Magic? I like magic. Always have.
Well, you,
I like it.
I like to think of this as a little bit of magic every Thursday.
Yeah. Well, as it is.
How do you think of it? Oh, you answered the question.
Yes.
Oh, that's how you think of it?
Yeah,
okay.
I do.
All right. That's good. I believe you.
But no one else could do the magic like you and I do.
Ooh, okay. Yeah. Well, maybe the Masters of Illusion, right? The Masters of Illusion live show based on the hit TV series where magicians are featured doing amazing things. They are going to do that which cannot be explained. How did they do that? I don't know. How is that woman levitating? How is that amazing escape taking place?
Yeah.
I have no clue. And my advice is don't think too hard about it, folks. Just go 8 o'clock Saturday night, a few tickets still left at the Voodoo Lounge at Harrah's Casino. Just let the magic wash over you. Don't question it.
And that's Brian McTee with his weekend
in
to-do list.
In short pants, I walked McTee. Out of the house like this. I can't believe it. I mean, it's too cold for this.
I know. It's very too cold. Well, thanks, buddy.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, how oppressed women from foreign countries are finding asylum in the U.S. Also, critical ballot measures for Missouri and Kansas that voters will be facing this election. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.